This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. Join us today for stories about the world's most vulnerable people and those who make a difference in their lives. On this week's program, Paying Off Doctors. An international consumers group says physicians in poor countries are being plied with perks.
What we are seeing from pharmaceutical companies are the likes of air conditioning units, mobile phones. In some cases, we've even seen domestic animals, such as buffaloes, being given to doctors in the developing world.
And getting kids out of the dirt. Nurseries come to construction sites in India. Plus, we visit a remote community in Mexico, where some people are just discovering their identities.
Growing up, we never thought about being black. I mean, we knew we were black just by looking at ourselves, at our skin. But if we're from Africa, well, cool.
That's coming up on the World Vision Report. In the U.S., there's concern about the influence big pharmaceutical companies have on healthcare policy. It's one of the topics currently being debated in the presidential campaigns. But it's not just healthcare policy that's being influenced by pharmaceutical companies. Doctors often receive lavish trips, expensive dinners, and huge speaking fees. In return, the company hopes or expects that the doctor will use or recommend one of its drugs. According to the group Consumers International, the situation is even more extreme in the developing world. Consumers International recently published a report on how drug companies influence healthcare there. Luke Upchurch, a spokesperson for the organization, spoke with us about gifts to doctors.
What we are seeing from pharmaceutical companies are the likes of air conditioning units, mobile phones. In some cases, we've even seen domestic animals, such as buffaloes, being given to doctors in the developing world.
Buffaloes, huh?
Domestic animals in some developing communities are what you would call the proverbial cash cow. To give just one example of a doctor in India whose comments have fed into the research here, he talked of a scheme from one pharmaceutical company where the doctor was to make 1,000 sales he would receive of a particular drug, he would receive a Motorola handset. On 5,000 sales, he would get a free air conditioner, and on 10,000 sales, a free motorbike. Now, for us, that does not lead to rational, responsible drug prescription.
This also happens in the United States. We see stories in our newspapers regularly about pharmaceutical companies' ties to doctors. What is the difference between the relationship of pharmaceutical companies and doctors in the U.S. and the companies with doctors in the developing world?
Well, we're just looking at varying degrees of the same problem. The gifts to doctors has been an issue of concern to the consumer movement in countries like the United States and in Europe for many, many years. And what we're seeing in the developing world is the same tried and tested marketing techniques now being pushed on these new emerging markets.
And there are regulations in the Western countries about how heavily drug companies can influence doctors. What kind of regulations are in place in these developing countries?
The short answer is not many. Where they are in place, often the infrastructure that is needed to implement and enforce those types of regulations just simply do not exist. Some of our research in India, for instance, found that the regulatory body that was set up to implement and monitor the behaviour of pharmaceutical companies in relations to doctors was radically understaffed to the degree of thousands of people.
How have you found that these extravagant gifts actually influence doctors in, say, India?
Well, there is a body of evidence out there by a number of well-established research institutions and from governments that has shown that it is estimated that 50% of medicines in the developing countries are inappropriately prescribed, dispensed, or sold. Our fear is that the influence that the pharmaceutical companies are having on doctors is contributing to this, or one in two prescriptions, if you like, being inappropriately or irrationally given over to patients.
What do you mean when you say irrationally given?
Well, it doesn't necessarily mean that they have the wrong drug, but they are not being given the right quantities or the right procedures for taking those drugs. You may also find that there are other ways in which ailments or conditions can be dealt with that aren't needed from new big drugs that have come onto the market. Generic drugs can do just as good a job and they can be a lot cheaper. So what we mean by irrational drug use is the use of pharmaceutical products above and beyond the patient's need. Now, this relationship of giving gifts to doctors, whether doctors would they'd admit it or not, does have some kind of effect on their judgment.
And do you know that? Have you done any studies that prove that? Because I'm sure many doctors deny at all that it influences them.
We're not saying for one second that every doctor out there is corrupt. There are some excellent, very high-standing, very respectable doctors in every country.
Who receive gifts from the pharmaceutical companies?
Who will receive gifts from the pharmaceutical companies, and some who will refuse gifts from the pharmaceutical companies. But it's interesting in the research that we pulled together for this report, in one particular study that was pulled into the report, we asked doctors if they felt that their prescription habits were in any way influenced by the gifts that they were receiving from doctors. They said that theirs weren't, but that all of their colleagues, or a big majority of their colleagues, were.
Now, Luke, you say one in two drugs don't even need to be prescribed. Who's paying the brunt of this expense?
This is another problem that we've highlighted in this report, that the money that is being spent in the developing world by consumers, by patients, when they go out and they buy drugs that have been prescribed or recommended by their doctors, every dollar that is spent there is so much more valuable than similar amounts of money spent in the developed world. At the end of the day, these are people, consumers, that do not have a huge amount of income. Massive amounts of their income is having to be spent on healthcare.
Mm-hmm. And now, drug companies would argue that they need to do this kind of marketing in order to make the profits they need to continue researching and providing the drugs that heal people.
There's certainly some truth in that, I would agree, and the pharmaceutical industry over many years has contributed tremendously to the advancements in health. We're not anti-pill, but we are anti-marketing of the pills and the drugs in these ways. One thing I would just mention is that you see twice as much money spent on the marketing of drugs than you do on the research and development of drugs.
I assume the drug companies have been made aware of your report. How have they responded to it?
Well, during the compiling of the report, this is the second report of this nature from us within the last 2 years. On both of those reports, we were very, very keen to involve and have a dialogue and have the pharmaceutical industry contribute in terms of providing us information about their marketing spend, how they themselves are interacting with doctors in the developing world. What we didn't have was any real response from any of these pharmaceutical companies whilst the report was being compiled.
So your group, Consumers International, has proposed what? If there was one thing that could turn this around, if there was one thing, what would it be? What are you asking for?
Simply, we're asking for a ban on gifts to doctors on a global scale. This would remove any issue or doubt in terms of the prescribing habits of a doctor. On an industry level, we would ask for more transparency, more dialogue, more accountability from these pharmaceutical companies.
Mm-hmm. All right, Luke Upchurch, spokesman for Consumers International, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
We spoke with Luke Upchurch from London. Paying off doctors is only one healthcare problem plaguing the developing world. In some countries, the biggest problem with healthcare is that people simply don't have access to it. William Powers knows this. He used to manage a public health program in Sierra Leone, run by Catholic Relief Services. He recalls an incident when the scarcity of medical care presented him with an awful choice. He tells us about it in this aid worker diary.
We slammed on the brakes as a villager threw himself in front of our jeep. "The girl," he said out of breath, "she's dying." I jumped out and followed the man through the village, just a couple hundred mud huts with shiny zinc roofs. As I entered one of them, a sour stench filled my nostrils. The silhouette of a pregnant girl took shape. Her name was Zara. Her big belly looked ready to burst, and bright red bumps covered her swollen legs. The nurse on my team examined her and declared, "This girl is going to die." Zara had a condition that was causing her body to swell up. It threatened the life of both herself and her baby. She needed a hospital with a blood bank. But the nearest hospital staff with a doctor was a 7-hour drive away. I radioed our office in the state capital for help, but my organization couldn't spare any vehicles. They were tied up in other work, fighting malaria, TB, and AIDS. As for any help from the government, the region's sole ambulance was in Freetown, a 10-hour drive away. Nausea slid from my gut into my chest. I couldn't focus. I felt lightheaded. We were supposed to be heading further upcountry to train traditional birth attendants and distribute bed nets. Palm trees swayed above the hut as I weighed the cost of turning my jeep back toward the capital. I did the cold arithmetic. In the time it would take me to rescue Zara, I might cause the death of 10 other people. Some would be infected with malaria because I didn't get them a bed net in time. Others would die in childbirth because I delayed training birth attendants. I looked at the girl. She looked back at me through her pain. And I did one of the hardest things I've ever had to do. I bent down, touched her scorching forehead, and told her that we had to leave her behind. My voice choked on the words. In the car, heading into deeper rainforest, my conscience had a sour smell, the smell of Zara's room. At that moment, I didn't know there would be a happy ending. I didn't know that later that day, I'd track down a vehicle that would rescue Zara. She would arrive safely at the hospital. All I knew then was how awful I felt. A colleague tried to comfort me as Zara's village disappeared behind us. "It was the best we could do," she said. "You can't always play the hero. If you do, many more Zaras will die." What she told me was true, but it was small comfort.
William Powers is author of Blue Clay People, Seasons on Africa's Fragile Edge. In this country, probably no one would think of taking a baby onto a construction site. But in India, some parents have no choice. They live on the construction sites where they work, and that often means their children are left to fend for themselves. Some of the luckier ones have a better option. Peter Aronson reports from a construction site in the city of Mumbai.
A group of toddlers sit in a circle on a concrete floor as a teacher gently applies baby powder and helps dress them one by one. This daycare center is a tin shack in the middle of a muddy construction site. It's part of a program called Mumbai Mobile Creches. Creche is a British word for nursery. It provides much-needed childcare for the construction workers who live in shacks right next to this one.
Some of the kids who come here haven't had a bath or haven't been cleaned well by their mothers, so it's essential to ensure that they're properly cleaned. Their parents go to work, and they don't have enough time to take care of all their children.
That's Vaishali Chandrakant Apras, the director of this daycare. Usually both parents work, leaving no one to care for the kids. These migrant families are amongst the poorest of India's poor, so they have few options, says Apras.
If there were no mobile creche, these children would be wandering around aimlessly. They would be playing in the dirt.
Instead, they spend their days drawing, painting, singing, and if they're old enough, learning to read and write. The center measures only about 650 square feet, and yet it's neatly divided. There's a preschool area where cloths suspended hammock-style serve as cribs, and there's a play area with chalkboards and a little classroom with red, yellow, green, and blue desks. The walls are plastered with students' drawings, the Hindi alphabet, and paper chains. At breakfast time, Vaishali ladles warm milk and a protein porridge called ragi into the kids' metal cups. She chants a little song which they repeat. It's a daily ritual. Children who finish their milk and ragi will become strong and healthy and will look good, the song goes. Devika Mahadevan is the chief executive of Mumbai Mobile Creches. She says the group was founded in 1969 by a well-off housewife in Delhi who was walking past a construction site one day.
And she came across this baby that was just lying in the middle of the dust and in the harsh heat and just crying. And his mother was away working on the site. And I think that touched her so much, she realized that this child is all alone, is completely vulnerable. So right then and there, she started the first mobile creches center, which the aim was just to protect and take care of these very young children.
There are now 60 centers in the cities of Delhi, Mumbai, and Pune. They take children up to age 12. The youngest child ever left in their care was only 3 days old. The group gets its money from the government, private donations, and the construction companies themselves. The builders also have to provide a place to house the center. It's not all that costly, but
there are many sites where children are constantly having accidents and dying, and they still don't have a center.
Without this free daycare, 4- and 5-year-olds often end up looking after their younger siblings.
By providing a mobile creche center, you actually take away the burden of childcare from the young child, and you support the parents.
Parents like Sarasvati and her husband Kariyappa, they came to work on this construction site from a poor village in South India. While she carries trays of bricks and gravel on her head, her 3 kids spend their days at the center. The couple says they're grateful for the program.
I come to check on my kids around 4 at the creche. I see whether they're studying, playing, crying. I just check on them and then I leave.
Education is beneficial because they can at least learn the basics, how to recognize or read a bus number, how to read signs, and this matters a lot.
The center also gives the children confidence to try new things. 12-year-old Naresh has shown a talent for art.
I used to see other kids drawing, and I used to wonder, why can't I draw as well as them? And so one day I just picked up the little chalkboard, and I put my hand to the board, and I just started to try drawing.
Thanks to private donations, he took some art classes. But Naresh also takes home more basic knowledge.
Especially about cleanliness, about how to keep my house clean, about how to wash my hands, that I shouldn't allow flies to sit on my food, because goodness knows what will happen.
Unfortunately, when the construction work here is done, most of these children will end up on sites with no mobile creche. But the organization has been training a group of 10 women, all wives of construction workers, as daycare providers. The hope is that these women will one day be able to run their own low-cost programs that can move from site to site with their families, making them truly mobile creches. For the World Vision Report, I'm Peter Aronson in Mumbai, India.
And now, our globe at a glance.
And it's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard rain's gonna fall.
A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall is the name of Bob Dylan's protest song that defined the 60s. It's now the title of an outdoor exhibit that's touring the world. The song was a response to the threat of nuclear war. The exhibition is a response to the problems facing the world in the 21st century. Dramatic photographs and writings that address poverty, climate change, and human rights are displayed on a 165-foot banner. Each photograph illustrates an image from Dylan's famous song. So visitors to the exhibit hear the song and see the image at the same time. A forest in Haiti without any trees, because the wood was needed for cooking fuel. Land that once provided food for the local community, now cracking under the weight of drought. The banners are displayed in botanical gardens around the world, from Sweden to Sydney, London to Madrid. The exhibit shows the deep connection between people and the environment in which they live. The creator, Mark Edwards, was inspired by something John F. Kennedy said. "Our problems are man-made," he said. "Therefore, they can be solved by man." Mark Edwards is hoping this exhibit is a step in the right direction. And that's our Globe at a Glance. I'm Peggy Wehmeyer, and you're listening to the World Vision Report.
It's hard, and it's hard, it's hard rains are gonna fall.
In the early 1990s, Carmen Cole started her own knitwear manufacturing company. Doesn't sound too extraordinary, except that Cole created the company to employ immigrant women and pay them a living wage. The company, World Tricot, blossomed and made clothes for the biggest fashion houses in France. But these days, World Tricot is struggling to survive. Anita Elash tells us what happened. She reports from Lourdes in eastern France.
There are just three people who now work at the World Tricot factory on the outskirts of Lourdes. One, an immigrant from Portugal, puts the finishing touches on a jade green cardigan. Another, an immigrant from Burkina Faso, is experimenting with a new design, working to get exactly the right combination of thread and stitch size for a deep blue men's pullover. And Kaja Zanut is working on eggplant-colored pullovers. Zanut has worked here 12 years, and her eyes shine as she explains her job.
I put everything together, the collar, all the pieces. I work with different styles, sometimes slacks, sometimes skirts or jackets.
Zanut is a Moroccan immigrant. She looked for work for 2 years before World Tricot hired her. She says her salary has meant she and her husband have been able to give their children a good life, and it has given her self-confidence.
Ah bah, ça me fait plaisir.
This gives me real pleasure.
It gives me courage. We work well. We give everything we can to do a good job. And it has allowed me to do a lot of things.
Zanut is here because of Carmen Cole. Cole founded World Tricot 17 years ago. Her mission was to employ immigrant and refugee women in jobs that were creative and reasonably paid. As she looks over the work, she tells me these aren't just sweaters on the production line, but works of art. They're also her last hope of keeping World Tricot alive. The company lost all its clients after it sued Chanel for alleged counterfeiting and breach of contract. Now a bankruptcy court has given Cole until April to turn things around. To do so, she's producing her own clothing line.
We're in a very difficult situation, but I have hope for the future because I'm an entrepreneur. I've created my new collection, Angèle Baptiste. I've hired people again, and I'm training them, so it's a new beginning.
She named her new line after her parents, poor Italian immigrants who arrived in France just after World War II. Cole left school at 14 to work in a factory. She eventually became a social worker, serving poor immigrant neighborhoods on the edge of Lourdes. One day, she was arguing with a friend over how to help the women in the neighborhood find work. Her friend challenged Cole to put them to work herself, and that's what she did. Cole got a loan, bought a sewing machine, and hired several local women.
At the time, these women couldn't get into the economic system because they had no training or resources. They were often single mothers or their husbands had limitations. So I said that by working the way I hoped, I could help liberate them so they wouldn't have to depend on anyone else.
Cole paid her workers 25% above minimum wage, and she trained them to produce the finest quality knitwear, crochet, and lace. By 2001, Cole had 90 employees. They worked for the top Paris fashion houses, Chloe, Yves Saint Laurent, Jean-Paul Gaultier, and of course Chanel. Then one day, while Cole was on a business trip in Tokyo, she saw a familiar white crochet pattern on a new collection in the Chanel boutique. She says World Tricot developed the design, but Chanel rejected it and then used it anyway. Chanel denies the allegation and has countersued. The company said in a statement that Cole's sample was produced according to Chanel's specifications, using materials it provided. Chanel was Cole's biggest client. And when it canceled her contract, that put everyone out of work.
The effect on our employees has been dramatic because people were working in the fashion industry. It was art. They gave the very best of themselves.
World Tricot faces an uncertain future. Cole is trying to make a go of it by selling the Angèle Baptiste collection herself during weekend trips to small towns and through a store at the back of her factory. Meanwhile, the judge hearing the case has asked an independent expert to examine the crochet design and give an opinion on which company it belongs to. The expert has yet to report back. For the World Vision Report, I'm Anita Ilash in Lourdes, France.
El Ciruelo may look just like another poor Mexican fishing village, but look again and you'll see most of the villagers are black. They're descendants of slaves brought here 300 years ago. The Mexican slave trade, which was abolished in 1829, was very small. Perhaps that's why it's been all but forgotten, even by its descendants. Conrad Fox reports.
On his dry, scrubby farm, Adan Baños is feeding his dozen or so cattle. I offer to help unload the bags of feed that are laced with chicken manure for nutrients, but he says no thanks. You'll get so smelly, not even black people will want to be with you. And then he laughs, embarrassed. It's not just that he realizes how offensive this sounds, it's because Baños himself is black. Baños's tight curly hair, tall build and dark skin clearly reveal his African heritage. I ask him what he thinks of those roots.
Well, I don't know anything about that. Growing up, we never thought about being black. I mean, we knew we were black just by looking at ourselves, at our skin. But What can I say? This is the first time I heard that. If we're from Africa, well, cool.
In fact, little is known about Mexico's black population. Estimates range from 50 to 500,000, mostly scattered throughout the country's southern states, and communities so remote, most Mexicans have never heard of them. Father Glenn Gemmett is the Catholic priest for El Ciruelo. He's a native of Trinidad, but came to work here 25 years ago to minister to Mexico's blacks. He says it's not surprising that people like Baños know nothing about their past. He compares the situation of black Mexicans to the country's other minority, indigenous people.
The Indian is closer to his past than the African is. But for both, the destruction did take place. The difference is that even though at some time the empire put a building, a Catholic church, on top of their pyramids and destroyed their temples and their monuments, they still have a stone that they can go back to and point to. Blacks do not.
But Gemmett hopes to bring the past back to life for Afro-Mexicans. A group of young men dance to the music of a harmonica and a cow's jaw rasped with a stick. They're dressed in furs and terrifying-looking masks. Audience members are dragged into the convulsing fray and whipped across the legs if they refuse. It looks painful, but it's done with good humor. This dance is being held in the rec center of a town near El Ciruelo. Its origins lie in dances brought from Africa by slaves, but it's been dying out in recent generations. Today, it forms part of a dance festival organized by Father Gemmett to promote Afro-Mexican culture among local black communities. The effort seems to be paying off. That's Tirso Salinas, one of the concert spectators. He said that outside his community, people don't believe he's Mexican because of his skin color. But he doesn't care.
I'm not going to do what Michael Jackson did, pay myself with milk to get rid of my color. If you're black, you should love yourself that way. That's how God made us.
On this night, many others seem to share the same pride. For the World Vision Report, I'm Conrad Fox in El Ciruelo, Oaxaca, Mexico.
And that brings us to the end of this week's show. Remember, you can hear us anytime online at worldvisionreport.org. And you can sign up for a podcast there if you'd like to take us with you. Our radio team includes Doug Boyles, Mark Bandy, Christina Darden, Lita Hartman, and I'm Peggy Waymire. Thanks for listening.
This program is produced with funding from World Vision. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization.